Welcome to the Totem Figures Podcast. I'm TJ Daw. Khalil Ashanti is a Vancouver-based writer and performer. He had a pretty solid idea of who'd be on his Mount Rushmore, so I'll let him describe it.
My Mount Rushmore would feature Richard Pryor, Eminem, Don Knotts, and then a blank space for Friends, okay. Which would I would say that would be Tops in Blue, Caesar's Magical Empire. Those are two of the biggest influences in my life, but kind of they kind of mean the same thing to me.
Okay.
Richard Pryor was a huge influence of mine because he took a chance to do something in a way that no one had ever done it before. You know, he always had Bill Cosby as his idol.
Yeah.
A lot of clean comedians, and for most people, they would say Richard Pryor didn't become clean. You know, he ended up being a dirty comedian, but I think that he ended up just showing what his life was on stage and didn't apologize for it.
Yeah.
And when I was writing Basic Training, that was my inspiration. I kept listening to Richard Pryor.
How did you get into him in the first place?
I was in the basement of our apartment, of our house in Davenport, Iowa, where I lived as a teenager. And my stepdad had albums that he had a whole stereo system, and he had albums, record albums, and he had thousands of them. Yeah, I was looking through the albums, and also I should say at this time in school, I was starting to have people tell me I was funny. I never liked being at home. My childhood was such that being at home home was hell for me. It wasn't a place that I felt safe. One of the things my stepdad used to do was make my brother and I stand at attention overnight while he was asleep on the couch. And as we were standing there, he would lay a belt across our feet so that if we moved, he could hear the buckle of the belt move and he'd give us a beating. At this time, I was 10, my little brother was 8, and we would be standing there at attention. And when you stand at attention for a while, your back starts to compress. It's one of the things they use at Guantanamo Bay. Hmm. And so my little brother would start crying. And crying was even worse than hearing that belt move. It was just weak. If you showed any weakness, my stepdad would, you know, he'd kick your ass. So to keep him from crying, keep my little brother from crying, I'd do impressions of my stepdad.
You crying about, boy? I'll whoop your ass, nigga. You know?
Quiet enough that it wouldn't wake
exactly.
him up.
Exactly, yeah. And I saw my little brother start to laugh, and I thought, a warm feeling came over me, and I couldn't feel the pain anymore. We were both standing there in the middle of the night, with our chests were torn apart, because he had hit us with a fly swatter, and it kind of, you know, so my t-shirt was sticking to my chest with blood-soaked chest, and I remember just wanting to make the pain go away, and making him laugh made my pain go away. So I get to school, and I'd start doing impressions of teachers. You know, the teacher would say something, and I'd kind of repeat it back in their voice, and people would start laughing. And so I kind of would hear that I was funny, and then I remember seeing Richard Pryor, this album, and it was an album of, it's called Was It Something I Said? And it just looked funny to me, so I popped it in, and just thinking, wow. The way he would take you to places, but I just remember really relating to the pain in his life, and there's one he did called Live and Smokin' where he talked about, you know, in white people's neighborhoods, there's banks on every corner. In black people's neighborhoods, there's whorehouses.
And he lived in one.
Exactly. He was raised in a whorehouse. He used to peek through the keyhole and watch his grandmother turn tricks.
But that's the world that he eventually created on his albums.
That's right. And he didn't apologize for it. He didn't try to soften it.
Right.
You know, he went from being a clean comedian because he thought that's what people wanted and to just saying, you know what? This is what I'm doing. This is me. These are the pimps and hustlers I grew up with, and this is the way they talked,
right.
And this is the way I see the world.
Drinking ain't cool. Drinking ain't cool. None of this shit's cool. I remember at home, man, dudes used to drink and shit and didn't want to fight. Some niggas drink, you know, and have a seizure. You know what I mean? You know, everybody know one nigga that drink and every weekend get his ass whooped. He never wins a fight, but he always want to fight. You know what I mean? Nice guy during the week.
Hi, how are you?
Weekend. Motherfucker! Get out of my face! You go to the bar, man. You see him in the bar. Cats be in the bar. Be fucked up. He starts, like, man, leave me alone, nigga. Shit, you ain't got to fuck with me, baby. Gives me some money. I buy my own shit, man. Say, man. Bartender, nigga, give me my whiskey. What? I'm drunk, nigga.
damn drunk, motherfucker. You crazy? Shit, you didn't say that an hour ago. You were selling me that shit. Baby, I'm bad.
Did it occur to you at all that you might want to do that for a living?
It did not until I was 14 and we did a talent show at my junior high school. And I did 45 minutes of comedy off the top of my head.
You improvised 45
minutes? 45 minutes. At Wood Junior High School in Davenport, Iowa. It was April 28th, 1988.
And it went well.
It went great. Got a standing ovation. 900 kids plus staff. The whole school was in this auditorium. Well, I was supposed to go for like 5 or 6 minutes and introduce the next act. But I was so nervous and people were laughing, I just kept going.
Like, were you doing impressions of the teachers? Like,
there's the guy named Cy Robinson. Cy Robinson was our football coach. And he kind of talked like this, and people need to quit jacking around. Get your work done. And everybody instantly knew who it was, and they were dying. And Coach Robinson was laughing so hard, his face was red. For most kids who hated being at school, to me, being at school was just a dream come true, because I wasn't living in the hellhole of home, and I was hiding everything that was happening at home.
You were just this funny guy around school.
Khalil's so funny. Oh, he's great. Everybody, you know, everybody likes him. And
what was going on inside you, thinking, like, I could really do something with this?
Yeah, what was going on inside of me was I need to run away from home and live with a family that'll let me be funny at home.
But then you joined the Air Force.
Yeah.
At what age?
18. 10 days after I graduated from high school. But the night before I left, my mom told me that the guy who had been abusing me my whole life wasn't my real dad. And she swore, she told me before, she said, I probably just forgot. To this day, she'll tell you. Khalil, I told you, you probably just forgot, boy. Okay, Mom. Yeah.
And what was that like to deal with when you were suddenly leaving home?
Oh, it was a ton of bricks. It was a ton of bricks dropped on my head because everything I was running away from crumbled. Now, keep in mind, this was a plan I had in motion for a while. Like, I really need to... I'm not going to sit here and be bitter. I'm going to get away and create my own life, you know, and I'm going to get away and I can be funny and I can, you know, I might not be a famous comedian, but at least I have something else, you know, to prove that I'm worth something.
Were you curious to find out who your biological father was?
No, not at all. Just because I felt like I was 18, I thought I was a man, you know, I figured, well, he probably left me. So what's the point? And I thought, well, if he hasn't taken the time to find me, he probably didn't care about me, and I'm not used to dads caring about me anyway, so I'm just as good without him.
Okay.
And so I come into the military with this kind of secret. But in the military, it's very easy to hide things because it's so testosterone charged. You don't show weaknesses. You don't want to talk about, you know, poor me, my dad abused me, you know. So I came into the Air Force June 16th, landed in San Antonio, started basic training, and found it not intimidating whatsoever. These drill sergeants. That's right.
So how did you hear about Tops and Blue?
In the recruiter's office, when I was joining the military, she said, you know, the Air Force is the hardest service to get into. If you do extracurricular activities and show involvement in your community, that means a lot to the Air Force, because the Air Force is... It's not like the Marines or the Army where you're, you know, fly, fight, you know. it's much more a 9-to-5 kind of job. And so I said, well, let's see, extracurricular, I go to Sunday school, at church, I do stand-up comedy, you know, at the Funny Bone Comedy Club. I've been doing that since I was a teenager. And she says, oh, comedy. She goes, you know, there's this thing in the military, in the Air Force, called Tops in Blue. And I remember doing my laundry one night, and there was like the dorms, and they had kind of a commons area. And you do your laundry, and there's a bulletin board. You know, if you wanted to buy a microwave oven or whatever, people would sell stuff. And there's a notice that said, Tops and Blue Talent Competition is next week. And I went and signed up. I tried out for Tops and Blue in 1992. And the way it worked was there's three tiers of competition. You compete at your base, which for me was Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas. And then there was a command level, or the kind of the regionals, which were in California. And then if you wanted the regionals, you'd go to Worldwide. And Worldwide is where Tops in Blue was selected from. So there were over 300 contestants, and they were picking 30.
And what were they looking for?
They were looking for potential more than anything. Okay. Potential and attitude. They didn't really care. I mean, the talent was a lot of it, But what I was soon to learn about the entertainment business is that talent is about 2 or 3%, and the rest of it's the hustle and the attitude.
Huh. Okay.
And so that's what Thompson Blue was looking for. And the first year I competed, I made it all the way to worldwide, made it to the finals, and I got second place. I didn't get selected for Thompson Blue.
Hmm.
I come back, I'm delivering mail, feeling sorry for myself, and that's where I met the first person that I would consider on the friend's face of my Mount Rushmore, which was a guy named James Garrett, who was one of the guys I used to deliver mail to every day, who saw me in the talent show and you know, not really following my career, but had heard of me around the way. And James Garrett was just a normal guy from North Carolina, you know, wife and kids in the Air Force, but was very, very smart about entertainment, which always intrigued me. This guy's never been on stage. So I'm delivering mail, and I was hanging my head, and he's like, "Airman Walton, what is your problem?" "Nothing. Here's your mail, sir. Please sign here." He's like, no. "Take this damn mail and hand it to me like you mean it. Because what you just did here is exactly what you did on stage. And I don't blame Thompson Blue for not picking your sorry ass." Sir, you heard me. You are talented. People would give... There's people in this world who have shitty jobs, who have to go to work every day, like me, would give anything to have the talent you have. And you're hanging your head? You need to get your... You're in Vegas, man. Get downtown and get to work. The next time you try out for Thompson Blue, I want to see you go. I want to see you on tour. And I said, "Well, since you know so much about entertainment, why don't you tell me how to put a routine together?" He goes, "You know what? I will." So he came over to my dorm room and helped me put a routine together.
Wow.
Which I took to Worldwide the next year in 1993. Won the base level, won the regional level, won Worldwide, and I got selected for Thompson Blue.
Okay. So what was it like to suddenly be in the show?
Terrifying. Thompson Blue is like Navy SEALs training, but it's entertainment. You sing and dance 18 hours a day.
18 hours a day.
Literally, without exaggeration, 18 hours a day. I was singing and dancing. I'm a comedian. I'm thinking I was going to make Thompson Blue and, oh, I get to do comedy. Yay! 18 hours a day. And it'll either make you or break you. The Thompson Blue, when I joined Thompson Blue in 1994, it had the similar washout rate to the Navy SEALs and the Green Berets. I heard Jeffrey Tambor, a former acting coach of mine, would say, "The biggest accomplishments of my life I had no confidence going into." And Thompson Blue is a perfect example. Like, it was one of those times where someone believed in me more than I believed in myself. And all I saw myself as was a comedian, but they saw more in me. They saw that I had a lot of fight in me and that I was trying to hide something, which meant that I had, I had something I needed to say. And they were going to try to break me to get me to say it. And that's what Thompson Blue is. It's an organization that since 1953 has toured and performed for the troops in places that, you know, for troops in harm's way.
And what are some of the places that you went with them?
Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, Thule Air Base in Greenland, Kunsan, Korea. Every Christmas we would perform for the troops in Korea, Diyarbakir, Turkey.
What was the show itself like?
Thompson Blue itself, the show is a musical journey from past to present with a unifying thread. And each year that thread is different. It basically, the point is to say that despite music, despite where we come from, or despite what services or what purposes we serve, we're more alike than we are different. And music is the best way to get that across. And my job in the show was not only to be the comedian, to carry the storyline along, but to also, I was dancing and singing in every number. And it's an hour and a half show. Uh-huh. Non-stop, high energy, like comparable to anything you'd see on Broadway. When you're on tour with Thompson Blue, you're also your own technical crew. So there were 30 of us, and we traveled with two tractor trailers full of equipment. 20,000-30,000 pounds of equipment. And we'd pull into, you know, the Spokane Opera House or wherever we were performing, and we would set up everything. We had our own power. We had everything. And then we'd do the show. So I would say...
And then you'd take it down.
That's right. And then we'd take it down. So out of a 10-month tour, 85 to 90% of the time loading and unloading the truck. The rest of the time you're on stage.
So you toured the world for 3 years?
Yes. 94 and 95, I toured with Thompson Blue. Two world tours back to back. And then in 97, in 96, I got out of the Air Force, honorable discharge, and moved to California, where I kind of couch surfed and auditioned in L.A.
With the ambition of what?
I wanted to do acting. I thought, well, okay, I've learned something pretty valuable from my Tops and Blue family because for the first time in my life, I felt like I belonged. Being on stage didn't have as much to do with my sense of belonging as loading the truck did. Because loading the truck was hard work, but...
And lasted longer than the show.
Exactly. And it told me that this business has very little to do with what you do on stage and a lot to do with the work you do off it.
Okay.
And so I just left with a renewed sense of confidence. And I had friends. I had, you know, people that were closer to me than my own brothers were. And that gave me a sense of family and belief and all the tough times. You know, when you go through something hard with someone, yeah, it just kind of, you gel with them
you
in a way.
You share that experience. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, right. Okay, so you went to L.A.
Yeah, I went to L.A. I started auditioning, couch surfing. Wasn't working out too well because I was thinking, well, I want to audition as a comedian. Like, I'm a comedian, right? I can also load trucks, but I'm a comedian. not many truck loading jobs out there. But I was also auditioning in Las Vegas because I had been stationed there. I knew I had a few contacts, and I auditioned and couldn't really get anything. And I got to the point where I was going to give up, and I got a job at Office Max. I got a 9-to-5 job at Office Max. It was a brand new Office Max. We were putting shelves in, and I heard about an audition for a show at Caesar's Palace, 18-city audition. They were looking for one person, and I was like, I got to go audition for that. Why not? I remember thinking, driving to this place, and driving to the audition at Caesar's Palace, and I don't know how familiar you are with Caesar's Palace, but if you think, there's a sports book, which is in the back of the casino. It's a huge place. The line of people auditioning went from the sports book, past the buffet, and almost to the entrance of Caesar's Palace. Easily 100 yards.
Wow.
150 yards. Just people lined up to audition for this thing, and they're all magicians.
And were you a magician at all?
No.
Right.
And so I'm auditioning, and these guys are, you know, they come up to me and they're doing these tricks. And hey, can you do that? And look, I can make my driver's license float. Ooh, you know, look at this card, pick a card. And
well, magic involves a lot of jokes.
It does.
Like a lot of patter, a lot of
build up. And that's what I noticed, is that these guys had the tricks, but they didn't have the jokes.
Okay.
All they were was the tricks. And I was like, well, I can fill in the blanks. You know, and if I can do an impression of you, a magician, and tell my jokes, I might be able to get this gig. And I still remember some Japanese, you know, so I wait my turn in line. And so I get into the, I audition for the gig, and they have you do a magic audition. They have you audition for, with your comedy, with your specialty, and then they have you do a magic audition. So I did comedy. They said, did you bring anything prepared? I said, I have 5 minutes to stand up comedy. Okay, go ahead. And I did, you know, a comedy routine. They thought it was really funny and clever. And I said, I can do that in Japanese. They were like, really? Okay, so I did it in Japanese.
So you're fluent in Japanese?
Yeah. And they said, none of those guys were fluent. None of the guys judging the auditions knew what I was saying. They were like, we have no idea what you said, but I'm sure it was hilarious.
So it could have been comedian.
Yeah, it could have been bullshit. Yeah. and then they had me go into a different room with a guy named Darren Romeo, who was the magic director, and I had to do a candle to flowers trick. And so he had me sit down and watch him perform it. And I got up and did an impression of him performing it and did it flawlessly as if I'd been doing magic my whole life. And I got the gig.
So what was the show?
It was Caesar's Magical Empire. And Caesar's Palace had basically rebuilt the catacombs beneath Caesar's Palace. So if you were a tourist or, you know, a guest, you could buy a ticket. They would transport you to the Roman catacombs and you'd have your own personal magician for the night. And you'd have dinner and 3-course meal and bottomless wine. And I was that person. I was the person that would entertain you.
Okay.
$75 a ticket.
And if the people happened to be Japanese?
Then I could perform in Japanese. And I translated the show into Japanese and made Caesar's Palace buy it from me. It became the only show in Las Vegas from 1997 to 2000 to offer the same experience in Japanese that was offered in English.
How often would Japanese people come?
More often after I wrote it, because I marketed it as well.
Okay.
Which, again, refers back to me learning that there's a business side to it, that, you know. But, yeah, by the time I finished at Caesar's Palace, they had, you know, a 25% increase in ticket sales just from Japanese tour groups.
And how did Japanese people react to a black guy speaking fluent Japanese?
Oh, they were pretty dumbfounded. I would always start in English. So I knew it was an all-Japanese group. You know, I'd do a show for a group of Japanese tourists, and I would start in English just to, you know, honey. And I'd say, oh, gomen nasai, nihonjin desu ka? which is saying, I'm sorry, are you guys Japanese? And they go, oh, sugoi! Which means, wow, amazing! And then I'd start doing the show in Japanese. I go, hey, daijoubu, which means, yeah, okay, no problem. Let me start over. And then I do it in Japanese, and they go, it's pretty cool. Pretty amazing, man. Some of the best times of my life. But
so quickly talk about Don Knotts.
Oh, Don Knotts. Yeah.
What got you into him?
Don Knotts. One of the things, when I was standing at attention, my stepdad liked to watch cartoons, and he liked to watch Andy Griffith, Hogan's Heroes, The Jeffersons, and Good Times. And I remember just standing there out of the corner of my eye watching Don Knotts. And the physical comedy he used to do was just amazing. And I don't know, it was just, and there's this thing he used to do with, he had one bullet, you know, he carried around one bullet in his pocket, was never in his gun. And when he'd have to shoot somebody, the way he'd try to, you know, put it in his gun, you know, people give Jerry Lewis credit for being, you know, one of the first physical comedians, and I'm sure there were many more, but I just don't think Don Knotts gets enough credit. I think he was genius. I think he was so small and so wimpy, but had so much heart. You couldn't deny.
Well, that's the thing, is like, you probably couldn't have less similar of a physicality to Don Knotts of anyone I could imagine. Like, were you a skinny kid? Like,
right.
Did you relate to him at all like that?
Oh, yeah. I was really wiry as a kid.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was really a little wiry, skinny kid. But I always tried to keep his earnestness. There's kind of the physical comedy that looks like you're being a goofball, and then there's the earnest kind of intention of...
Yeah, right. Like, you really are trying to get that bullet, and you really are scared.
That's right.
Okay.
And I found that's the difference between Don Knotts and some of the other kind of more tomfoolery kind of comedians, where it's a little too obvious.
Right, okay. So. Tell me about Eminem.
Eminem is somebody that influenced me in the last 10 years only because of what he came from. The fact that he came from nothing and admits it and uses that to sell music, I just think is pretty admirable. Eminem's family background is that his father left when he was young. His mother was never much of a mother to him. His house would get robbed by crackheads who used to come in and they'd make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and they'd throw their jacket on the chair. So they'd come home and find stuff missing from their house and see a half-eaten peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Okay.
Like, that's how comfortable people were with robbing his house. And, you know, one time he came in and caught him taking a nap. And so he just kind of grew up with just having to scrape for everything. Nothing was ever given to him. Rapping for him is what comedy was for me. I sit back with this pack of zigzags and this bag of this weed. It gives me the shit needed to be the most meanest MC on this sea, on this earth. And since birth, I've been cursed with this curse to just curse and just blur, just berserk and bizarre shit that works. And it sells and it helps in itself to relieve all this tension, dispense and these sentences get in this stress that's been eating me recently off of this chest. And I rest again peacefully, peacefully. But at least have the decency in you to leave me alone. It was a world that, and I mean, with obviously difference, him being white and wanting to be a rapper wasn't easy for him, but he knew he had skill because some people who had no reason to believe in him believed in him when he didn't quite believe in himself and wouldn't stop.
Right, right.
And so that was my James Garrett. That was my Thompson Blue. That was, and I just see the parallels with it, and I can just really relate to the way he didn't really know if that's what he wanted, but that's all he had. And for me, comedy was all I had.
And you wound up writing this one-man show about your experiences in Thompson Blue.
That's right. About my experiences in Thompson Blue and how I tried self... Basic Training is a show about me trying to run away from myself. Running away from my past. But these people on my Mount Rushmore kept leading me back to it.
And the people from Thompson Blue eventually bought you the airplane ticket to go meet your father.
That's right.
And what was it like to meet him?
It was pretty overwhelming. It wasn't the Oprah reunion I imagined it to be. Oh, father! You know. It was pretty weird. Because I look a lot like him.
So you recognized him right away?
Right away. Yeah, I remember hearing his voice first. He goes, hey, Khalil. And I turned around and he goes, I knew it was you. And he laughed and it sounded like my laugh. I was like, whoa. You know? So it was really... I would describe it as quiet. It was a lot of just looking at each other. You know? It was definitely unforgettable.
And how does he feel about this career that you've carved out now as a writer and performer?
He's pretty impressed with it. All parents see that their kids are special. But my dad told me the night that I met him again in 2004, he said, when your mom and I were dating, we were teenagers in Germany, we're walking behind the school, and he picked up a rock and started writing on the wall of the school, which back then was like vandalism, right? He's like, my mom was like, what are you doing? You know, and she's like 16 and he's 17. And he's like, just watch. And he put the name, he put the letters K-A-H-L-I-L on the back of the wall. And she said, Khalil, what is that? He said, that's going to be our son's name. She goes, but I'm not even pregnant yet. He goes, I know, but we're going to have a son named Khalil, and he's going to bring laughter and understanding to the world.
Wow. And he was right.
I guess so.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
For more information on Khalil's performance schedule and career, go to khalilashanti.com. He also blogs at gigsmacked.com. I'm TJ Daw, and this has been a Totem Figures podcast.